Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound, by David B. Williams, narrated by Jonathan Todd Ross. Preface. In the summer of 2018, I grieved with millions of people around the world. Our collective sadness focused on a 20-year-old mother, Tahlequah, one of a dwindling number of orca who regularly visit Puget Sound. On July 24th, Tahlequah had given birth to her second child, a daughter, who died within 30 minutes. For the next 17 days, she carried the 6-foot-long body of her dead offspring on a journey of more than 1,000 miles. Finally, Tahlequah let her calf go. Our hearts broke. Then, 2 years later, on September 6th, 2020, it was with much joy that whale researchers announced Tahlequah had given birth 2 days earlier. The healthy and precocious boy calf, dubbed J57, was born in the Strait of Juan de Fuca after an 18-month gestation. Researchers have high hopes the baby will survive. To paraphrase Emily Dickinson, hope is a baby orca in Puget Sound. Mourning the loss of a child is a natural response for humans and orca. Both species are smart, self-aware, and deeply connected to their families. Clearly, Tahlequah, like us, had loved her daughter and did not want to part from her. And as we learned, her extended family tried to help by providing food for the grieving mother. Ecologists suggested that they might also have been mourning with her. Tahlequah and her family are members of a group of more than 70 orca known as the Southern Resident Killer Whales. Orca are not actually whales, they are in the dolphin family. These animals, which have evolved a culture and community unique to their home in Puget Sound, travel together, hunt together, and communicate using their own distinctive dialect. Solidifying their cultural affinity, the southern residents also rely on the collective knowledge of their elders, particularly the matriarchs, who act as guides and teachers to their family members. Why shouldn't they also love and grieve together? And why shouldn't we also love and grieve with Tahlequah? Few animals are as sacred and iconic to Puget Sound residents as orca, or in more dire straits. Habitat loss, disturbance from noise and boat traffic, exposure to an ever-increasing toxic mixture of pollutants, and overfishing of their favorite food, salmon, have pushed the southern resident population to the point where their very survival in Puget Sound is in doubt. For many who followed Tahlequah, their grief for her was compounded by their grief for the environment of Puget Sound, and the way its degradation affects orca and humans. If Tahlequah and her calf couldn't thrive, what did it mean for us? More than any other story, Tahlequah's loss crystallized the central environmental challenges of Puget Sound. The orca are suffering. The salmon are suffering. We are responsible. I had been working on this book for 2 years when Tahlequah and her baby became globally known emblems of Puget Sound. Their story came at a critical moment. In the past few decades, restoration efforts have created a Puget Sound healthy enough to support the majority of its species, yet not healthy enough to fully support iconic species such as salmon and orca. The human residents have to decide how to act. Will we continue working to restore the ecological health of Puget Sound, or allow it to suffer from our actions? What prompted me to begin this book was my longtime fascination with exploring the past to better understand the present. For the most part, my earlier books focused on local stories, as in Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography, where I had a simple pair of questions. How did the early settlers in Seattle reshape the landscape to suit their needs? And how do those challenges still influence the city, its residents, and its development? I hoped that by answering those questions, I would help people develop deeper relationships and stronger connections to their home landscape, as well as an awareness of how we affect the natural world around us. For most of my life, I have lived within a few miles of Puget Sound, the narrow inland sea between the Cascade and Olympic Mountains. As Chapter 1 explains, though, the geography is more complicated than this basic definition. I knew that I lived by troubled waters, but I did not fully grasp the magnitude of the crisis that had been rising around me, like the tide submerging a low island. Although I saw myself as someone deeply aware of my natural surroundings, I realized I simply hadn't paid close enough attention to a place I love and where I intend to reside for the rest of my life. I needed to ask the same questions about Puget Sound that I had asked about Seattle. I needed to take heed of all the people who have lived here, how they have related to the landscape over the millennia, and how their stories could provide a better understanding of the conditions now shaping the lives of modern residents. Furthermore, as a writer who has generally focused on stories about the land, I had not fully appreciated the water and those who dwell in it. Standing on the shoreline or riding a ferry and seeing only the surface of the water, which tends to appear untainted and beautiful, I had long failed to see the interconnected lives of the plants and animals beneath, and to understand how they sustain and breathe life both metaphorically and literally into Puget Sound. The effects of human activity, overfishing, pollution, and climate change, reach deep beneath the surface. Our actions, their lives, our lives. We cannot cut one strand without unraveling the many connections that link us. This book, then, is my way to rectify my lack of understanding of the cultural and ecological history of my home waters, and to provide a resource for others. The more of us who know and care about this place, the more momentum we can build to change our ways. We have reached a critical confluence for the waters of Puget Sound. Paraphrasing Wallace Stegner, is this a native home of hope where we can create a society to match its scenery? Or will we succumb to baser values? As I learned of the origins, complexity, and connections of Puget Sound, I realized that the stories began to tell a biography of place. In the introduction to her book, The Presidio, the geographer Lisa Benton Short writes, simply defined, a biography is a written account of a life. In this case, the life is that of a place. What follows is a biography that represents my interpretation of a unique set of circumstances and opportunities. It is just one of many stories that could be written. A biography of a human being tells of the interactions between the protagonist and others, be they family, friends, coworkers, or enemies. A biography of a place tells the stories of interactions among the more-than-human inhabitants, as well as between the people and landscape, the people and the flora and fauna, and the long-term residents and newcomers. Many stories could be written about Puget Sound. In this biography of my home waters, I have chosen stories that distill the essence of this place. Some have previously been overlooked, such as warfare and native people's struggles over thousands of years to protect their homes. The stories of the kelp and herring, the Sound's most ecologically important plant and animal species, and the history of the Mosquito Fleet, the poetically named vessels that presaged the modern transportation network. Others are more iconic narratives, including those of the salmon and orca and their unique adaptations to the Sound. Collectively, these stories help us understand how the human and more-than-human residents made their homes in this landscape. My stories also tell how people have inhabited this home, used its natural resources, traveled through its landscape, and defended the place they cherished. These stories focus on both non-native and Coast Salish peoples, the latter of whom have resided in the Puget Sound region for millennia. Throughout this book, I use the terms Coast Salish, Native, and Indigenous to refer to the native peoples of Puget Sound. Coast Salish more broadly refers to indigenous peoples in the United States and Canada who speak one among the family of languages known as Coast Salish, which is spoken from northern Oregon to the northern tip of Vancouver Island. Within Puget Sound, two of the many distinct languages and dialects in this family are Lushootseed, which is spoken more widely, and Tuana, used primarily around Hood Canal. In including native stories and voices, I certainly make no claim to be authoritative or to speak for anyone else. I simply hope that I have been respectful of the culture, the history, and the knowledge embodied in them. For my stories of natural history, I have focused on lesser-known but key species, including geoduck, arguably better known than understood, rockfish, and Olympia oysters. Their stories illustrate the complexities of the ecosystem and accentuate how the actions of residents have direct effects on the health of Puget Sound. They express why it is imperative that we act now to address threats to these species' survival. These accounts share many themes with the stories of salmon and orca: habitat degradation, overconsumption of resources, inadequate science, poor decision-making, and human arrogance. By looking across the ecosystem and seeing the connections that bind it together, we can understand better what habitat restoration looks like and make wiser choices for recovery of the entire Puget Sound ecological community. Many of my stories required getting out in the field, and I was privileged during my work on this book to tag along with biologists who regularly fish, dive in, and dredge deep into Puget Sound. I have been struck by their passion and knowledge, as well as their desire to share both with the general public. Despite the challenges that face the Puget Sound ecosystem, it is in far better health now than it has been for much of its recent history, primarily because scientists, citizens, and government officials have worked together to clean the water, curtail industrial pollution, and reduce resource extraction. As one ecologist told me, you have to wonder if orca and salmon would exist if we hadn't already begun to change what we do. The improvements that have occurred certainly do not mean that all is well. Recent events, such as the loss of Tahlequah's calf, remind us that although the overall health of Puget Sound has improved, many species still struggle for existence. One of my intentions in blending human and ecological stories is to highlight what I consider the most significant change in the human history of Puget Sound: how the European settler mindset of land ownership and resource extraction has begun to evolve toward a relationship to the waterway based on connection and respect, and how that shift in turn has fostered the ecological improvements. By this, I mean that modern-day residents of the Sound are less likely to view the water and surrounding land from an economic perspective, which tends to be, though is not always, exploitative, that from the perspective of recreation, science, and stewardship, which are more likely to generate connections to a place based on appreciation and responsibility. This change in viewpoint has occurred in part because resource extraction jobs, such as commercial fishing and logging, have been replaced by jobs in areas such as technology, service, retail, and healthcare, particularly in the large cities that now dominate the population and politics of Puget Sound. It has also taken place as scientists have started to conduct more studies and to learn more about the ecology of the waterway and how it has suffered by past and present actions. If policymakers and residents are to fashion an enlightened plan for how to act in the future, they need to work toward a more interwoven and nuanced consideration of the nature and culture of the waterway. Adopting such a new way of thinking has the benefit of greatly expanding the potential to create a thriving Puget Sound, hospitable and accommodating to all forms of life. One challenge, though, is that many residents know little about the health and history of Puget Sound, have a limited emotional connection to it, and don't see an urgency to work on cleaning and restoring it. And most scientists I spoke to expressed a need for more studies and better monitoring of the plants, animals, land, and water. But they also noted that we already have enough knowledge and commitment to work toward a better Puget Sound. By taking these actions, the people of Puget Sound can inspire others around the world. In the words of my friend Linda Mapes, whose stories about Tahlequah for the Seattle Times captivated readers, we are in a unique situation in Puget Sound, where we have a convergence of people who want to protect the ecosystem, the knowledge of what we need to do to meet this goal, the funds to pay to do it, and governments willing to explore how to do it. If trying to restore a damaged ecosystem cannot happen here, then where can it occur? Since I began writing Home Waters, my own enhanced appreciation and understanding of Puget Sound's incredible diversity, beauty, and potential for recovery have led me to believe that the most valuable assets of Puget Sound are not the resources we have long extracted, but the relationships that residents can make with this place. Learning from the past is central to forging and nurturing these relationships, and to creating a positive future for Puget Sound and all its inhabitants. By taking this journey, I feel I gained an extra dimension of sight. Now, when I look out over the surface of the Sound, I can see deep into its history and the peopling of the landscape, its residents' travels by canoe, steamer, and ferry, their endeavors to carve out a living, and their fears of invaders. I can see deep underwater to lush forests of exquisite beauty and complexity, to corpulent clams that can outlive people, and to fish whose annual spawning creates a spasm of desire attracting uncountable numbers. I can also see into a future where I have hope. If the residents of Puget Sound hold this place to be special and unique, as I think we do, then we will recognize our responsibilities not only to this generation, but to the generations to come, human and more than human. Chapter 1. Birth of a Name. On Puget Sound alone, there seem to have been in the neighborhood of 10,000 proper names, wrote the ethnographer T.T. Waterman in 1922. I have secured about half of this number, the remainder having passed out of memory. This is a fundamental truth about place names. Like the natural world, they are constantly changing to reflect how different peoples relate to the land. This change is evident in Puget Sound place names, which reflect choices made by indigenous, colonist, settler, and later inhabitants. Exploring how and why each group has chosen particular place names to define locations in and around Puget Sound provides essential insights into those groups and their relationship with the landscape. Consider the oldest place name we know of. Accented X, superscript W, schwa L, accented C, often written in English as Wulge, W-H-U-L-G-E. The word comes from Lushootseed and means a stretch of salt water. It is an onomatopoeic word. The verb form refers to the noise that waves make as they come up on the beach. But Wulge is more of a concept than a defined location, more of a way to delineate a relationship to place for the waterways' Coast Salish people. In another of Waterman's works, Puget Sound Geography, he wrote that Puget Sound dwellers considered those who lived far up the rivers and in the mountains as greenhorns. People who lived on salt water were better bred and wealthier and had access to better resources. This distinction was reflected in their vocabulary. As Waterman's informants told him, if a child behaved unbecomingly or exhibited bad taste or bad breeding, he was told, "Similar thou art to that fellow from yonder Issaquah." When someone used the word wolge, they did so in part to distinguish themselves from those who lived in less desirable locations. The use of wolge also reflects the Coast Salish inhabitants' relationship to the landscape. We were and are part of this place. We were caretakers. We didn't have the perspective of ownership. That's why you won't find specific names for places, such as Puget Sound, says Warren King George Jr., oral historian for the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe. Instead, place names reflected features of the environment that affected daily life. For example, of the 605 place names that Waterman collected describing parts of Wolge, 202 were descriptive terms, and another 126 referenced food, human activities, plants, and animals. If your worldview is from a canoe, it is very different from that of an explorer, who had a top-down view, says Dennis Lewark, historic preservation officer for the Suquamish tribe. In contrast, many of the prominent place names that now appear on maps of the region reflect the ideas of a single man, George Vancouver, the British explorer who led the first known European expedition into the Wolge. Sailing aboard the HMS Discovery, he left England in 1791 and arrived in the Wolge in May 1792. Like many Royal Navy explorers, Vancouver frequently named geographical features in honor of a colleague or patron. For instance, on June 3, 1792, Vancouver named the Gulf of Georgia in honor of King George III. The preposition of implies ownership. That same day, he also named Possession Sound, the place where he claimed formal ownership of the lands he was exploring, in the name of and for His Britannic Majesty, his heirs and successors. If he had asked, Vancouver could have learned that the Lahoochid names for places around his possession sound referred to birds, canoes, plants, and topography. Vancouver, however, did not record any Lahoochid names he might have heard, even in corrupted form. Considering how often expedition members' journals mention interaction with residents, it seems highly likely that Vancouver and his men must have picked up some place names. But to have adopted indigenous names would have acknowledged that others already inhabited the place. Nowhere was this naming practice better illustrated than on May 29, 1792, when Vancouver made his most significant naming decision, and one that continues to influence how people describe that landscape. Referring to a week-long exploration south of modern-day Seattle by his lieutenant, Peter Puget, Vancouver wrote in his journal, "Thus, by our joint efforts, we had completely explored every turning of this extensive inlet. And to commemorate Mr. Puget's exertions, the south extremity of it I named Puget's Sound." Vancouver's use of the possessive form illustrates a naming convention typical of British explorers. It was another way to signal that the location had been claimed. As with many similar names, the possessive apostrophe S was later dropped. The precedent had been set. A newcomer's name would replace the name used by the indigenous people. Vancouver's choice of the term sound was unusual. The more common bay and gulf could both have been applied to the waterway. A gulf is defined as a portion of the sea, partially enclosed by land. A bay is a small gulf. Sound comes from both Old English sund, meaning water or sea, and Old Norse sund, meaning swimming or strait. It was a term favored by Vancouver and his former commander, James Cook, who bestowed it on many features they encountered in their journeys, including King George III's Sound in Australia, Queen Charlotte's Sound in New Zealand, and Prince William Sound in Alaska. Vancouver's original description limited his lieutenant's name only to the waters south of what is now called the Tacoma Narrows. All the water north, as far as what Vancouver called Point Wilson, near Port Townsend, he named Admiralty Inlet. Neither of the narrowly specific definitions for these locations survived long. Today, Admiralty Inlet refers only to the passage between Port Townsend and Whidbey Island, whereas Puget Sound has grown to 70 times its original area. Not that the shoreline has changed. People have simply altered their nomenclature to suit their needs. Puget Sound's greatest official expansion occurred in 1987, at the hands of the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority, established by the Washington State Legislature in 1985, to evaluate pollution-related threats to the Sound's marine life and human health. In its first comprehensive management plan, the agency defined its authority as encompassing Puget Sound south of Admiralty Inlet, including Hood Canal and Saratoga Passage. The waters north to the Canadian border, extending westward to Cape Flattery, and all the land draining into these waters. One way to think of the state's definition is as Greater Puget Sound, whereas the water south of Admiralty Inlet is known by some as Puget Sound proper. By the state's definition, Puget Sound comprised not only the inland sea, but also its watershed. Every inch of land where precipitation fell and flowed into a creek or stream or river that emptied into the Sound. This included the 14,411-foot summit of Mount Rainier, whose north side drains into the Puyallup River and Tacoma's Commencement Bay. To the west, it extended as far as Beach Creek at the northwest corner of the Olympic Peninsula, more than 170 miles from Mount Rainier. With this definition, the authority sought to emphasize that what people do on land has a direct impact on the health of Puget Sound. Whether it's farmers using pesticides in the Skagit River Valley, residents dumping pharmaceuticals down their toilets in Seattle, industries washing toxic substances into creeks, or hatcheries treating fish with antibiotics, restoring, maintaining, and sustaining a functioning Puget Sound ecosystem requires not only clean, healthy salt water, but also clean, healthy fresh water flowing into it. This definition of the Sound reflects the priorities of those who created it, in this case, a state agency with the mandate to assess the health of the unique and unparalleled resource of Puget Sound. The authority needed a definition that was useful, practical, and manageable, as well as boundaries that could be clearly designated, so that the legislature could see if progress was being made. Over time, and in part because of the imprimatur of the state legislature, the area defined by the authority has become part of the regulatory framework that guides federal, tribal, and state agencies. Recently, another name has come into use, one that explicitly recognizes the Coast Salish inhabitants on both sides of the international border. Many people have started to refer to the waterway south of Admiralty Inlet as the southern part of the Salish Sea, a term coined in 1988 and adopted by the state in 2009. The Salish Sea encompasses Puget Sound proper, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and the Strait of Georgia, which runs along the east side of Vancouver Island. A principal goal of adopting this name was to recognize that the inland waters of Washington and British Columbia form a single integrated estuarine ecosystem, irrespective of the legal boundary between the United States and Canada. This understanding is particularly important to Native peoples, who traded, traveled, intermarried, and fought across this waterway for generations. The two names offer two logical ways to view the geography. Salish Sea highlights modern ecological, cultural, and political issues, while Puget Sound proper reflects the way many residents envision the sound and the issues that affect it. This narrower definition.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?